And you know, the industry has changed quite a bit. 10, 15 years ago, none of what you see happening today was in the newspapers or was even considered. And over the last really 5 years, it has completely evolved to be a very profitable, very strong business model for threat actors and cyber criminals around the world.
If you're a technology partner looking to optimize your engagement with the tech giants like Microsoft, you're in the right place. Welcome to The Ultimate Guide to Partnering with your host, Vince Menzione.
Welcome to the 29th episode of The Ultimate Guide to Partnering. My guest for this episode is Dan Mannion, the Vice President of Partners and Technology Alliances for Armor. Armor sets the standard for managed cloud security services, delivering protection, detection, and response for data workloads and applications, no matter where they're hosted. In this episode, Dan talks about the importance of security in today's volatile IT environment, the three types of threat actors, Armor's secure platform and how it secures over 1,200 customers in 45 countries today, how he thinks about partnerships, alliances, and channels, and how channels will be such an important part of Armor's growth moving forward. I hope you enjoy this episode, and thank you for your support and for listening to The Ultimate Guide to Partnering. Dan, welcome to the podcast. I'm delighted to welcome you here today. You and I have known each other for quite some time. You're the Vice President of Partners and Alliances for Armor, a company focused in on managed cloud security services, and your organization partners with the hyperscalers, some of our partner listeners, and customers to deliver world-class solutions. So welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you, Vince. It's a pleasure to be here, and got very excited when you invited me to be able to participate in this. So looking forward to speaking with you and sharing some of our journey with your listeners.
To start off, can you tell our listeners a little bit about Armor, the company's value proposition and mission, and how that's evolved?
Sure, happy to. So Armor has been in the market since 2009. We were founded to be the most secure virtual private cloud hosting company on the planet, and did that very effectively for the first 5 years of our existence. Grew from nothing to over 1,000 customers in 45 countries. And then we decided to look at where's the next leg of growth going to come from. And we looked at going after federal business. We looked at investing more in international expansion. But we couldn't ignore that giant sucking sound that came from the Seattle area, which was the Amazon cloud as well as the Microsoft Azure cloud. And when we saw what was happening in the industry, coupled with some of our top customers coming to us and saying, hey, we really love what you do in your environment by securing some of our most important applications and some of our most critical data. But we're still going to take some of our applications to Amazon, some of our applications to Azure. Can you productize your security and take it with you? And that was really the inspiration for us to go down a new path, which led us to our second line of products in the market. So today we're a managed cloud security services provider. Think of us as a security SaaS firm that deploys solutions into a customer's environment, wherever that environment may be. And then we provide the 24/7 managed security services behind that with a world-class military-grade security operations centers team at our headquarters in Dallas, Texas.
So security is such an important and complex topic, and it's top of mind for so many people today. Can you take us novices behind the curtain a little bit and break down what the aspects of security are and what the solutions that you provide do?
Sure. Well, anytime you're talking about security, the first thing you need to understand is what are you trying to be secure from? And so from a strategy perspective, we always take a focus on what are the threat actors out there doing? What kind of threat actors are coming after us, and what kind of tactics and data are they after? And you know, the industry has changed quite a bit. 10, 15 years ago, none of what you see happening today was in the newspapers or was even considered. And over the last really 5 years, it has completely evolved to be a very profitable, very strong business model for threat actors and cyber criminals around the world. And so what we've seen is that there are three types of threat actors in the market today. One we call the C threat actors. They're commodity threat actors. They're people just starting out in their careers, they're kids on campuses, they're downloading free software and running scans against your environment and trying to figure out if they can use common cyber techniques to try to hack into your environment. Sometimes they do it for profit. Most times they're doing it for fun. The challenge for most security firms is that that causes a lot of noise and distracts them from protecting against the really bad guys, which are the B and the A actors. The B actors are the ones that you read about in the newspaper. And this, the timing of our podcast is very germane because this is the week that we all learned about the Equifax breach. 143 million personnel records and private information from U.S. citizens have now been leaked to a criminal gang. And that criminal gang is going to be using that data for some time to their profit. These are highly sophisticated, very well-funded criminal networks coming now from all corners of the planet. It used to start out of Eastern Europe and Russia. We now see these types of gangs coming out of Brazil, Indonesia, China, India, you name it. There are these gangs are executing every day, 24/7, and they run highly efficient, almost call center-like businesses in order to drive profit to their bottom line. And then the last group are the A threat actors. And most of us don't need to worry about those A threat actors because those are the taxpayer-funded threat actors. Those are the NSA operators, Israeli intelligence, German intelligence, the British intelligence. So these are threat actors that are after nation state secrets, the intellectual property of the next aircraft carrier. So as long as you're working with customers that don't have that kind of super secure and important information, those are threat actors that you don't have to worry about. Unfortunately, those are the most sophisticated because those are the ones you'll never read about in the newspaper because they really are good at not only just getting in, but getting in undetected and getting what they want without anybody ever finding out. So in summary, there are three types of threat actors out there. And what it's most important for us to understand is what kind of data do you have and which type of threat actor would be after that data? And then you start to construct your security program based on that knowledge.
So you mentioned that Armor has a security, is in the security platform business. Can you explain what that is and take our listeners through how that solves for some of the threat actor issues you just discussed?
Sure, absolutely. So as we decided to develop our security program and strategy to protect customers from A, B, and C threat actors, we found that treating every customer as a snowflake was going to be a very challenging way for us to go about that business. If you try to secure every single customer differently, you don't get any cost efficiencies and you don't get any scale efficiencies in terms of how you can protect all customers from threats you see across that environment. So we decided to go down the path of not investing in security tools and trying to build the next generation of a security tool at a particular compute stack layer. But instead, we decided to invest in building a security platform. We call that platform Spartan. And what Spartan enables us to do is to secure over 1,200 customers today using the same exact security stack. And then we can manage and orchestrate that stack using the Spartan platform. Where that gives us great advantages is if we see a, let's say a banking customer that's getting attacked with a certain type of malware, we can reverse engineer that malware using our threat researchers and our incident response team. And then when we figure out how to block or remediate that malware, we can then write the signatures into our security tools for all 1,200 customers almost immediately. And so you get a great benefit of being able to understand what's going on from one attack vector and then protect all of the customers that are protected by that Spartan platform fairly seamlessly. And it's all included as part of our standard service for our customers.
So as a service, you're able to replicate it very quickly and provide it out to all of your customers. That's amazing.
Absolutely.
So I'm moving to the cloud. You talked about a lot of your customers moving to the cloud, moving to Amazon, moving to Azure and the like. And what happens now from a security perspective once I move my data, my applications to the cloud?
That's an incredibly important question and something that's really misunderstood in the industry. We actually encourage our customers to move to the public cloud because if you look at the investments that Amazon, Google, Microsoft, and others are doing to build those data centers, secure those data centers, create the role-based access to ensure that none of their employees have access to your environment. It's really phenomenal the kind of security controls that they've been able to invest in, automate, and put in place. However, there is this thing called the shared responsibility model that all public cloud providers have. And the shared responsibility model states that the cloud provider will secure everything up to the virtual machine that your application is sitting on. Now, the virtual machines that you sit on, your application servers, your database servers, and then all of the network ports that you open up in order to access your environment, that is 100% the responsibility of the customer to provide those security controls around. And unfortunately, that's very misunderstood. In fact, when I give talks at technology conferences around the world, I'll ask the room, how many of you are moving to the public cloud today? And invariably, 70% of the hands go up in the room. And then I ask, how many of you understand the shared responsibility model and what that means from a security perspective? And usually only two or three hands stay up. So it's a very important concept, but unfortunately a very misunderstood concept in the market.
That's amazing. And I thought all along that the cloud providers provided all that security, kind of embrace the application and the whole stack. But what you're saying is that's not the case. So what do customers then need to do once they have this shared responsibility?
Well, there's always three choices for every single customer who's going into the cloud. One, do nothing. So maybe you're just putting up a public website and it doesn't matter if it gets hacked and the data there is public anyway. Don't invest in securing something that doesn't need to be protected, and that's fine. Or two, you're going to build your own security model. Now, that requires you to understand how you do security in the cloud, which is different than you're going to do it in your own data center. And then it also requires you to go out and try to shop through the marketplaces at the public cloud providers and figure out which solutions from which vendors are going to be best served in securing your environment. Then you've got to build integration hooks in between the different solutions that you're going to stack up into your environment to protect you. And then you have to go out and hire those super smart security professionals that are incredibly hard to find and very expensive to retain and build a 24/7 security operations center team. And then the last choice you have is you can partner. And that's the area where Armor's been incredibly successful with customers, especially in the mid-market and going all the way up into the enterprise. Because doing cloud security is a new muscle, even for grizzled veterans in the security business. And so we can deliver security and 24/7 monitoring services very, very quickly that allows customers to still take advantage of that public cloud flexibility and agility that they've really been promised from those providers.
So who would be an ideal customer of your organization?
Yeah, we do incredibly well in mid-market companies up to the lower enterprise space, just from a size. The reason why we do incredibly well there is they are large enough to have data that threat actors care about, and they also know that they could be at risk, but they're not funded enough to replicate the kind of 24/7 security operations center team that we have, or that maybe, you know, a Fortune 50 company like a JP Morgan might have. We also do incredibly well in any kind of financial, healthcare, or any regulated industry. So those companies that have PII information, that have credit card information, that have financial data for customers, healthcare information on individuals, anybody who has that type of data that really, really needs to be protected because that's core to your business model and to the trust that you have with your customers, those organizations are through and through a large percentage of our 1,200 customers today.
So you're the VP of Alliances and Partners. Can you take our audience through what the outcome and the mission for your role is?
Absolutely. So we treat the alliance relationships and the partner relationships a little bit differently. I have a small team focused on our relationship with Microsoft and Amazon. And really the way that we approach that is, how do we first use those relationships to give brand differentiation to Armor? So anytime we can have the Armor brand and the Amazon brand, or the Armor brand and the Microsoft brand show up together in front of our prospective customers, it just quickly adds credibility to that Armor brand. Second thing we try to do is work with those companies to create technical differentiation in our platform. So if I can more deeply integrate into the Azure cloud or into the Amazon cloud, and provide features and functions that differentiate me against my competitors, then that gives me great value in the market. And then lastly, we look at those relationships to start to drive revenue and opportunities for us. So how do we craft our value proposition so that Amazon and Microsoft sellers understand why Armor can accelerate their customers' move to the cloud and remove that fear, uncertainty, and doubt of security and compliance. On the partner side of the business, we have worked hard over the last year to really understand what is the best profile of partner for us. And we've really started to settle on three profiles. One are the cloud migration consultancies out there. And there are large companies going all the way up to Accenture, down to, you know, small 5-10 person regional shops that that have a really bright people and some great expertise in a particular area. So cloud migration consultancies are great for us because at some point, as you're moving to the cloud, you've got to answer that question for the customer. Hey, what about security and privacy in the cloud? And Armor can be the easy button to continue to accelerate those migrations. We also work with the born in the cloud MSPs, who are actually managing the Amazon and Microsoft infrastructure on behalf of customers and simplifying that process. They also get asked about that security and privacy question. And then finally, we work with security and infrastructure resellers, because those resellers who grew up usually selling a lot of gear into a particular data center or colo facility on behalf of a customer, they're shifting into helping customers move to the cloud as well. And so we also have a great value proposition to help them do that.
So tell me a little bit more about working with both of the, or two of the top hyperscalers. How do you split your business between Amazon and Microsoft?
That's a great question. We initially split our business 50-50. So we try to go after those guys with the same level of investment, time, and energy. And then as we developed relationships with those providers, and we saw the direction that they were both going into, we've started to shift about a 70-30 split. So 70% of our time and investment is really invested in AWS, and about 30% of our time and investment is invested in Microsoft. And there's really two core reasons for that. Number one, on the one of them is customer driven. So as we go out and engage customers and talk to them about their cloud journey, 70% of the time, they've already made the decision that AWS is their destination of choice. And only 30% of the time we're seeing that that Azure is winning that conversation. So we have to go where the customers are asking us to go. And then secondly, when we look at the partner ecosystem, we found that while we love our Microsoft partners, they get torn in different directions because of the breadth of offerings that Microsoft has. So for example, you could be working with a partner one day on an Azure project, and then the next day they won't return your call because they're doing Office 365 migration. And then next week they're working on Windows 10 deployment. And the week after that, they might get back to the Azure business. Whereas when you work with an AWS committed partner, there's only one thing for them to do. They can only sell AWS. They can only sell that cloud infrastructure and help companies migrate into that environment. So we found it's just been a little bit easier from a go-to-market perspective to work with the AWS ecosystem.
And you mentioned the three classes of partners. You have a pretty complex solution. So how do you enable those partners to be successful?
Wow, that is the million-dollar question for us right now. It's been a lot of heavy lifting in the short term. I have a team of partner development managers around the country, so two per region, so six total, and then I have one guy in the UK. We have a dedicated partner solution architect in our business. And so for the first 100 partners that we've onboarded over the last 12 months, it's really been a manual process. We have a very formal onboarding process, but it requires either us traveling to the partner or the partner traveling to us, and then going through a series of trainings where we teach them both from a sales enablement perspective, as well as a technical sales enablement perspective, which is a super important thing we've learned over the last 12 months. Really, how to identify an Armor opportunity, how to help qualify that opportunity, and then when to bring us in as the security experts to help them bridge that gap. As we go forward, I'm really looking for new solutions on how I can take that to scale, because I can't get from the first 100 partners to the next 300 partners using that very manual model today.
So do you have your own certification process?
We are evolving that, absolutely. So we're completing the technical sales enablement and working with our solution architecture team as well as our security team to ensure that we understand what we want people to be proficient in. And then 2018, we're going to take that on where we can actually create certifications, test individuals for those, and have tracking mechanisms to know who's done what and where.
So I'm one of those three classes of partners, right? The SIs, the MSPs, and the security firms that provide solutions. Why would I want to partner and align with Armor?
It's a great question. Couple of things. Number one, generally, these companies want to partner with Armor because they're looking for a way not to slow down their core business, which is either the selling of security services, the migration of workloads to the cloud, or the management of those workloads. And the number one blocker that we hear from these companies is this fear, uncertainty, and doubt that customers have around security. And unfortunately, these companies aren't security specialists either. So oftentimes, they'll have these migration consultancies will stop, and they won't be able to deploy their cloud architects for another 3 months, another 12 months, as the customer tries to investigate internally, how are we going to be secure in the cloud? So the number one reason we get chosen to do this is because we remove that blocker. We remove that that fear, uncertainty, and doubt. Long-term, the feedback that we've been told about why our partners are excited to continue to partner with us is we have a very unique stance in the market where we can actually provide security for a customer, one of our partners' customers, in any environment that they want. And that's very unique. Most of the solution providers we compete against might be specialists in AWS, or they might be specialists in Azure, or they recommend going into Rackspace because that's where they've done most of their business. The Armor value proposition and how we productize what we our security solution, it's called Armor Anywhere. We can literally take it to any data center to secure any workload that you want. And that's a great value proposition for cloud migration companies, cloud MSPs, and security resellers to embrace.
Now, you talked about the 100 moving to the 300 partners. Can you talk a little bit about the company and where it's headed, and where do you see the growth?
Sure, absolutely. So today, 1,200 customers, 45 countries. We have about 250 people in market. Most of them are in our Dallas HQ area. I'd say it's about 80-20 split between HQ and around the country and around the world. Where we really see the growth coming from is twofold. Number one, we see it coming through our new Armor Anywhere solution. And we're really excited about that because it's both a it gives us more at-bats, so to speak, because we can literally secure you anywhere. There's very few customer conversations we can get into where we can't figure out a solution that works for that customer. So we think that's going to be a huge lever of growth for us. We also think international expansion is going to be a huge lever of growth for us. And the thing that my board and my leadership team are incredibly excited about is expanding through partners. At the end of the day, when I first came on board about 18 months ago, the company was doing about 10% of revenue through the partners that existed at that time. And they were very SMB-oriented partners. And so we really had to hit the reset button, redesign all the different partner programs so we could go after and work with partners that were focused on that core mid-market to the lower enterprise space. Since we launched in July of last year, we've now shifted 30% of revenue to go through partners. And if our pipeline works out the way I'm hoping to by the end of this year, we'll be up to 50% of revenue. And so we're really putting our money where our mouth is and demonstrating that we're committed to building a very robust partner business and working with the top players in those markets to bring security to their customers.
Wow, that's outstanding growth from 10% and mostly SMB or small partners to almost 50% of the business I'm hearing you saying.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And because we've been moving up market with these trusted partner relationships, we've also been setting records in terms of deal size. So we're going from average deal sizes of about $2,500 a month to deal sizes north of $10,000 a month and setting some seven-figure record deals as well.
So what do you think are the characteristics or what makes a great partner?
That is a fantastic question. Well, when I start to engage companies, the first thing I try to understand is culturally, are we aligned? Is this a business that does well partnering, and are their executives committed to those types of relationships, and can they prove that they've done that in the past? So you got to have some level of cultural alignment that's important for these types of partnerships to be successful. Secondly, can we define what our unique value proposition is in the market? If we combine our solutions together, can we have a definition of what our company and your company can do uniquely that we can't do with any other of your competitors in the market? And if you can get to that unique value proposition, then it's something very easily for your sellers to adopt. And then that's the last area that we really examine, which is this friction-free for your seller? Are they talking to the same buyers that would naturally purchase an Armor solution? If we're asking those sellers to go talk to new buyers with a new value proposition, that's way too much friction for a seller who's trying to make their quota every month and every quarter. So are we aligned on from a value proposition, that unique value proposition, and are we already selling to the same buyer? If you can check those three boxes, then we have the makings of a successful partnership.
So when you came in 18 months ago and looked at that 10% of the business, were there some partners that just weren't getting it? And what were the characteristics of partners that weren't succeeding?
It was very reactive. So usually we actually had, let's see, when I first came on board, we had 291 partner agreements signed. Only about 23 or 24 of those partners were active. And we had no way to forecast the business. And that's because what had usually happened is the partner was looking for a solution on behalf of their customer. They somehow found Armor through a Google search or through referrals in the industry. They came to us to solve that one particular customer solution, but it wasn't aligned to their core business. So just like we talked about the three makings of a great partnership, we never came up with a unique value proposition. It wasn't core to how their sellers were going to market already. It was just a, hey, we're reacting to a customer demand and let's see if we can find a provider to help them. So that's where we really wanted to shift gears as we went into 2017 and start to focus on the alignment of those types of partners where culturally we're aligned, we can build that unique value proposition, and we're already talking to the same buyer. That's where we're really seeing the traction.
And you mentioned earlier going to market with both Microsoft and Amazon. And what does that look like? I mean, are there any things you're doing specifically to reach customers jointly?
Great. Another great question. What does that look like? A lot of work is what it looks like right now. as you know, the sales forces of Amazon and Microsoft are driven very hard. And there's ecosystems of tens of thousands of partners that are trying to get their attention. And so how you evolve these relationships to make them not just about brand or about technical differentiation, but get to that revenue generation element, it takes a lot of heavy lifting and a lot of hard work. So the two areas that we're focused on is, number one, can we construct a very specific Amazon value proposition and then a very specific Microsoft value proposition, because they're different. They're going to respond to different ways of how you tell your story. Can we construct that in a way that's simple for them to understand and very easy for them to consume? And then secondly, are we holding accountable our sellers and my partner development managers to actually go out there into the market and build relationships with key decision makers and key leaders in those field organizations? If we can do that, and if we can continue to show up where Microsoft and AWS show up, and we can be consistent in how we engage them and show value to them month over month, quarter over quarter, then you start to see those become not just those Barney relationships where we're swapping brands, but they actually become productive revenue generators for you as well.
And you mentioned prior to our starting the podcast today that you're doing a roadshow with Microsoft that's coming up here soon.
That's right. We are kicking off a 15-city roadshow where we've selected 15 different markets. We've selected a regional partner that's an existing Armor partner in each one of those markets. And then we're working with a Microsoft Azure solution architect to host a 3-hour migrating to Azure securely event for our joint customers. And so the registration has been phenomenal. Our goal has been to get to about 25 customers in every MTC. And we're currently exceeding that for, I'd say, 2/3 of the markets that we're going into. So it's very exciting. And we think that's also going to accelerate how we go to market with Microsoft in those local regions.
So any other advice for partners looking to engage with you or your organization?
I would just say reach out. If you have an interest in security, if your customers are concerned about security, privacy, and compliance as they're thinking about moving to the cloud, reach out to us. Come to our website. We have a very simple way to get engaged. And my team is incredibly focused and motivated to find strong partners that we can go to market with. And I think that's a key point that I want to make before we close out, is just spending the last decade of my career at Microsoft and looking at the ecosystem of partners and truly understanding what it takes from a time, resource, and investment perspective to go from a great idea to actual revenue in market. We're not about just trying to sign up 300 partners and have a bunch of logos on our website. I will turn away more partners than I engage, because when we do engage a partner, We're committed to building a go-to-market plan. We're committing to doing events together, webinars together. And we really want to turn that into a profitable relationship for both companies. Otherwise, you know, why are we in this business today?
That's a great commitment from your organization, Dan. And I hope our partners are listening or paying attention to that. Hey, I want to shift gears here a little bit. And we're going to provide links to your information in our show notes for sure, so partners can reach you personally. But I did want to spend a little bit of time. And as you know from listening to other episodes, I'm fascinated with how people got to this particular spot in their lives. And I was hoping you could share with our listeners a little bit more about how you got started and how you got to this point in your career.
Sure. That would be great. So I actually started my career as a technical recruiter on Wall Street, coming out of my undergrad program at Penn State. And the only reason I took that role, in fact, I didn't even know what kind of role I was taking, to be quite frank. The only reason I took that role is they had advertised a 6-month training program to teach new grads about the software, hardware, and system administrator markets at the time. What I didn't realize at the time was the only reason they were doing that is so that we could convince, we being 22-year-old kids, could convince men and women who were IT professionals with car payments and mortgages to leave their job at one company and go take a job somewhere else. But it was a great training, both from the standpoint of understanding the market and the industry, and then they spent 6 months really training us up on how to be very proficient sellers in the market. And I was blessed that that particular opportunity took me to where I live today, which is Austin, Texas. I moved to Austin back in 1996, and I just got caught up in the excitement that was the internet boom that was going on. There were startups that were popping up all over Austin. I was placing engineers into companies that were going public, and they were becoming paper millionaires overnight. And then I'd call them 6 months later, and they'd say, I'd say, hey, this is Dan. How's it going? And they'd say, Dan, who? Like, I'm Dan. I'm the guy who got you your job. And I couldn't believe that that I was on the sidelines watching this happen. And that's never been my personality. I like to get in the game. So I talked myself into my first software sales position at a startup called iChat. That was successfully purchased by another company. I then talked myself into another software sales job called Acuity. And then finally found a really great startup called Hire.com, where I spent the next 6 years of my life. And one of the things that I'd encourage young people to think about when they're coming out of either college or high school or their grad programs is what type of company you want to go work for. And what I really found that first decade of my career is working at small companies gave me an immense amount of exposure to decision-making, to our executives, to how we think about resource investment, et cetera. I just became a business person, not just a salesperson, because I was exposed to those types of leadership conversations and choices that we have to make. And then I was looking about 11 years into my career, I've been carrying a bag and leading sales teams, direct sales organizations, when someone encouraged me to look outside the company, because if I wanted to pursue my path, which was to eventually lead a software business or become a CEO of my own software company, I had to understand that still 90% of all software is transacted through channel partners. It's through an indirect sales model. And that's when the light bulb went on. And just through some great relationships and friendships that I still hold dearly today, I found my way through a referral into a great opportunity at Microsoft, where I then got to spend the next 10 years of my career really learning how the largest and most successful software company on the planet builds partner ecosystems in order to scale their products around the globe. So that was the last 10 years of my career. And now I'm excited to start to apply those back into those learnings back into smaller companies and hopefully do the same and build Armor and whatever next chapters come into my life using the knowledge of the direct and indirect sales experiences that I've had.
And what did you get your degree in?
Great question. I actually went into college to be a surgeon. I was a pre-med undergrad until I was my junior year in college when I had a very heartfelt decision to decide not to pursue medicine anymore. And then I got a marketing degree with a psychology minor. I actually thought about becoming a psychology major. And then I said, you know what? I don't want to sit around and listen to people's problems all day. So then I went into sales. And you know what I started doing? Sitting around listening to people's problems all day.
Exactly. I also was a marketing major, so I could relate to that. So what is the most fun aspect of the job for you?
Oh, it's the journey. Frankly, it's you know, I came here and there was three people in my team. One person is still a great contributing member to the team. She's been fantastic. One person I moved into an account management role, and she's really excelling there. And unfortunately, one person, we had to move out of the business pretty quickly. It just wasn't the right fit. We've been able to build a terrific team with diverse sets of skills, and to see that team come together and create this set of partner programs, which is now getting the kind of momentum in the market that we've talked about, man, that's really what it's all about. To be able to work with great people, to give them an opportunity to do their best work, and then to see the impact that work has, not just on our business, but in all the businesses of the partners and what they're investing in order to build these joint businesses together. And that's been the most rewarding part of this journey.
So what was the best piece of advice that you received when you got started that maybe you impart to others that you mentor?
Let's see. I've gotten a ton of great advice in my career. So if I could boil it down to one nugget, the one thing that that I always try to do that I think is going to be super important no matter what stage of your career is in, is just be great every day at what you do. You need to wake up every day and try to be the highest level of excellence, be dependable, be reliable, do what you say you're going to do, understand how to manage and set expectations appropriately so that you can always exceed those expectations, and just try to be the best possible individual contributor, manager, executive, whatever level of your career. As long as you just wake up every day and try to be great at what you can do that day, I've found that your career and frankly your life is going to work out just fine.
That's an awesome piece of advice. It reminds me of a saying by John Wooden, who I admire quite a bit, make each day your masterpiece.
That's funny that I agree 100%. It's funny that you mentioned John Wooden, because one of my favorite quotes that I use with every team that I have had the pleasure and privilege to be able to manage and lead is one of his quotes, which is he used to tell his players every day, "Your actions speak so loud, I can't hear your words."
You know, we talked about a very successful career in technology, 3 startups. I bet each of those have their unique stories. But what about hurdles? Did you have to face any hurdles in any of these organizations, and how did you overcome them?
Wow, that's a long list, Vince. I'm not sure if we have 3 more hours.
we can extend this into a series. How's that?
There you go. Yeah, the Mannion obstacle series. Every role, every company, every week, frankly, of your career, you're going to face hurdles. You're going to face obstacles. Some of the ones that were most, not challenging for me to overcome, but important, I think, for me to overcome was in those transitionary times. So when you're trying to go from being an individual contributor to a manager, and when you're trying to go from a manager to being an executive, understanding how to be self-aware and realize that what got you from A to B is not the same set of skill sets that will get you successful from B to C. And so I think number one, trying to figure out how to become the most self-aware individual that I could and be honest with myself and realize what I'm good at and what I'm not good at, and try to steer my career in areas that I can, that the role can maximize my strengths, and not try to steer my career into roles where I'm not fit well for that particular job. I think that's been really the best learning for me over the last 21, 22 years, is really understanding yourself, understanding what you're capable of, and then find roles and environments with the types of people and managers and leaders that you're inspired by so that you can do your best work.
So what advice would you give your 22-year-old self?
The first thing I would say is you're not as smart as you think you are. My 22-year-old self is pretty confident, pretty smart. And what I realize now looking back is that was just more ignorance than anything else. And so I'm glad that I had leaders and mentors throughout my career that could help me become more self-aware and see that in myself and teach me how to better apply my confidence, my energy, my passion that I have in every job that I've ever applied myself to. And then the second thing I would tell my 22-year-old self is just keep going. People underestimate the power of just keep running, keep moving in a forward direction through whatever obstacle that you face, through every challenge, lost job, company that gets bought and now you're reporting to people you don't like, whatever the case may be, just keep going, keep driving forward, and it's going to work out better than you probably think it is.
Yeah, I like to refer to that as persistence, right? Grit, determination, persistence, all those kind of words come to mind when you mention that.
Yeah. Grit's become one of my favorite words. I agree 100%.
Me too. So if you had a personal billboard, and this is somewhat of a metaphor, but what would you share on it?
What would I share on my personal billboard? I went through an exercise at Microsoft a long time ago, which was you had to go through 52 values and get to what are your 6 core values. And that really had an impact on my life because it got me to stay focused and understand what do I care about and what's going to be core to my character, to my spirit, to my mind. And if I can continue to find ways to apply those values into my work, and then find organizations that value similar things, then I will be successful. I'll be able to make an impact and I'll feel satisfied at the end of every day. And so if I had that board up right now, I'm confident it would have those 6 values on it.
Do you remember what they were?
Yes. So number 1 value is family. Number 2 value is health. Number 3 value is passion. Number 4 value is risk. I like pursuing things that have an opportunity for growth and an opportunity for failure as well. Number 5th value is fun. And number 6th value is challenge.
Nice. Very nice. And what do you do for fun when you're not working?
I chase after my kids, who are now 10-year-old daughter and 8-year-old son, and just embrace every moment that I get to have with them and see them blossom into really super cool, fun people that we get to hang out with as much as possible. And then the one area outside of my family that I'm still super passionate and committed to is I play soccer competitively. So I actually run an over 40 premier team and what is a very competitive soccer community here in Austin. And we have set our targets on winning the league championship this year.
Very good. So how about books? Do you get to read often? And is there one book that you've read and gifted often?
In terms of books, some of the more foundational books that I read that I still recommend to people in their 20s are some of the Carnegie books. So How to Win Friends and Influence People. That was an incredibly meaningful book that I actually read towards the end of my college career and really taught me a lot of great principles of how to interact with people, how to be a value-added person. Back then, I was a big fan of Ayn Rand. Atlas Shrugged is a fantastic book. I've read probably every solution selling book from the mid-90s to the end of 2010, when I finally stopped reading them, realizing they were all just repurposed versions of the same process. So those are some of the books that I've embraced and really been enjoyed. And just in general, I find that I'm more of a nonfiction reader than a fiction reader.
Yeah.
The other ones I would... that I really love and we'll go back to actually. If you're in the technology industry, you got to read the Geoffrey Moore books. It started with Crossing the Chasm, then Inside the Tornado. And I just recently picked up his latest one, which is called Escape Velocity, that he wrote maybe 5 years ago. But if you're in technology, sales, and marketing, having the foundation of understanding how technology markets cycle is incredibly important because it helps you see where your company is in the market vis-a-vis your competitors. And it's foundational if you ever want to lead a technology market. And then personally, I always try to learn more about people and have a deeper understanding of people. And so I continue to read books and magazines about psychology and social psychology. So I love the Malcolm Gladwell books. Mm. I've always thought Malcolm Gladwell just frames things really interestingly and teaches you about, by applying the way that he looks at the world, he teaches you about why we behave the way we behave. And you can use that to your advantage as you continue to grow in your career.
Any last advice for our partner listeners, for our audience out there before we conclude?
I don't know if I have advice. Just encourage you to go be the best you can be every single day. And if there's an opportunity for us to work together, please reach out to me and please reference this podcast. I'd love to find that there are more and more great partners out there listening to Vince and the great work that he's doing in the market today. And if that would be, if this conversation could be one spark of interest, that would be special to me.
Thank you, Dan. And for our listeners to find you, what's the best way?
Daniel.Mannion@armor.com.
And there's two N's in Mannion, M-A-N-N-I-O-N.
That's correct.
For our listeners, right? And are you on social at all?
I am. You can reach me at dmannion for Twitter. And I am on LinkedIn and have been a little more active this week on LinkedIn. I think I set off a firestorm by stating something about Equifax. So that's been interesting. But yes, you can reach me on Twitter, LinkedIn, and would love to interact with anybody socially as well.
Great. Dan, thank you so much. You've been a great guest. Been delighted to have you on the podcast. Such a great topic to talk to our listeners about as well. So thank you very much.
You're welcome. And thank you, Vince. It's been my pleasure.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of The Ultimate Guide to Partnering with your host, Vince Minzione. Online at ultimateguidetopartnering.com and facebook.com/ultimateguidetopartnering. We'll catch you next time on The Ultimate Guide to Partnering.